Welcome to Warships Pod. And in this episode, we'll be devoting things to the US Navy and looking at some hot topics, including some of those covered in the recently published Warships IFR Guide to the US Navy 2025. There are going to be two guests on this episode, the first being Dr. Emma Salisbury and the other David Axe, who will be joining later on in a separate segment. Dr. Salisbury is a fellow at the Council on Geostrategy, specialising in naval matters, defence-related industrial policy and military procurement. She recently completed her PhD with a dissertation focused on the history of the US military-industrial complex. She is also a senior staffer for a Member of Parliament and a contributing editor at War on the Rocks. Welcome, Emma.
Thanks so much for having me back, Ian. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to have you on again. So I think we ought to maybe kick things off with a general question, which is, what do you think the state of the US Navy is as we sail into 2025? I mean, would you assess it as being in rude good health or a little bit poorly?
I think it's like most of us have probably had on our report cards from our teachers at some point, could do better. It's, I think a lot of Western navies are at this point now where the amount of investment that is needed in order to get our navies up to scratch is actually really quite substantial. And we all have to grapple with actually putting that money in, making those plans and really planning these things properly. And the US Navy is no different. Obviously, the Americans have a much larger budget than the rest of us in NATO do. But that doesn't mean that they are doing everything perfectly. And it doesn't mean that there isn't more investment that is necessary. So I think the US Navy is still the best Navy in the world, but there are lots of things it could do better.
I mean, when they talk about navies, they often go on about size. So, for example, the US Navy, as you just said, being the best and most powerful, but not the biggest. So how do we balance out the size and the power bit? And how does the US Navy edge it, would you say, over the Chinese?
I think we have to really think about the balance between quality and quantity. It's the same in the naval domain as it is in land and air as well. And as the old saying goes, quantity has a quality all its own. So the fact that in numbers terms, the Chinese Navy has overtaken the US Navy is really not something we can ignore. However, it is not just the number of ships, it's also how you use them, the doctrine, the operational planning, all of that side. And it is also about the people who are on your ships. And I think in those latter two points, the US Navy does still edge out the Chinese Navy, particularly because the Chinese have not had any substantial combat experience for, 40 years now since Vietnam, and haven't had any naval combat experience at all. So I don't think we should write off every other navy because the Chinese Navy has edged us all out in terms of numbers. But I think it really should be a wake-up call for the US Navy that to keep its predominance in the naval sphere, it is really going to have to think about both quantity and quality and not just rely on that quality to mean that it could beat China in any kind of future conflict. What that comes down to is ultimately mass. And I think a lot of that mass is going to have to come from uncrewed systems because the sheer complexity and expense of traditional surface crewed platforms is such that you're not going to be able to catch up quickly with the Chinese. So that kind of mass, I think, can come much more easily and much more cheaply from uncrewed systems.
And would you say that the US Navy has to avoid a repeat of the littoral combat ship and be very careful about the way that it's going with the new frigate, because it appears to be heading in a direction of being over specified, gold-plated, at a time when they do need that mass? So do you think they've got no room left to make another error like the LCS?
The Constellation is frustrating me greatly because when the project was originally proposed, the Navy very carefully said that they were going to learn the lessons of the LCS and that they weren't going to go down all these holes again. And then they ended up doing it anyway. So it is very frustrating for those of us who have been pointing out these problems for a long time, and a lot of people longer than I have, And to see the Navy kind of wandering straight back into that barbed wire again is very frustrating, particularly when they seem to have recognised the problems beforehand. Especially with Constellation, because Constellation is based on a French-Italian design, the Fremme, and it is a perfectly good frigate. And there are going to be some tweaks that the US Navy needs to make in order to make it fit with what the US Navy requires. But the sheer volume of changes that the US Navy keeps making and tweaking and adding and moving around, and it's very difficult for the manufacturers of that ship to keep up with it. And it does really seem from the outside, at least, to be the US Navy just having a tweak on things fun. And there doesn't seem to be any kind of operational necessity to keep doing that, which begs the question of why can't you just build a Fremme with a little extra in it and have a very, very good frigate.
And of course, that leads on to a very crucial part of it, which is the fact that there's only a finite number of shipyards and people that can build complex modern warships, surface vessels and submarines, etc. So there's been quite a bit of news and quite a few headlines about the USA's shipbuilding woes and the pressures that are on there, which, of course, you wrote about that in the Guide to US Navy. So is that something that they should really get right first as the basics before they try and, if they want to, grow the US Navy?
It is such an underpinning for any advancement in the fleet for the US Navy. And although there doesn't yet seem to be a final decision on how big the US want their Navy to be in the fullness of time, any of the options that's on the table requires a substantial amount of ship construction. And the shipyards in the US as they are at the moment just will not be able to handle that. Partially for reasons of sheer capacity. And a lot of the shipyards are also taking on maintenance for the US Navy. So the public shipyards, the four that are owned by the federal government, are supposed to be doing the maintenance. But because of problems there, they are having to push some of their maintenance off to the private shipyards, which then takes capacity away for construction at those private shipyards. So that's going to be a huge problem, is literally how many ships can be built and how many ships can we build with that maintenance pressure not being fixed. And then on top of that is the skills piece of it. Because as you say, constructing a really complicated, expensive modern warship requires vast amounts of skills and very, very niche things that it is very difficult to train people to do quickly. These are people you need to recruit, retain, train over their working lives, and have those skills kept within the industry to be able to fulfill those roles. And there's a really big problem at the moment with both recruitment and retention in the shipbuilding industry. So then, even if you fix the capacity problems in terms of physical facilities, if you don't have the people to use those facilities to build ships, you're still not going to build any ships. So it's very much a problem that needs to be solved quickly. And it is very frustrating that this has been a problem for at least 30 years. And no administration really seems to have got to grips with that until the Biden administration, who I think have done actually a pretty good job of kicking off a lot of this investment, as has the Congress. But at this point, is that too late? Because if you're looking at a Navy that needs to be ready for conflict in two theatres, against China potentially in the Indo-Pacific and against Russia potentially in the Euro-Atlantic, the Navy as it is now and the Navy that the US can get to in the next 3, 4, 5 years, is it ready?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. And when it comes to the US Navy and the future, the near future, within the next, 10 years or so, the big question of the moment may be, not just for the US Navy, but for the UK and the Australians, is AUKUS, the alliance that has got many layers, but the headline bit being the submarines for the Royal Australian Navy, nuclear-powered submarines for the Royal Australian Navy, with the idea that the Australians will have Virginia-class submarines from the Americans and then go on to an SSNR, Sorry. Yeah, no, not SSNR. I've got that wrong. It's AUKUS SSN. They keep changing it. Built with the UK. So a lot of what seems to be vociferous opposition in some quarters in the USA and Australia to the whole idea of it, or because the Americans are saying we need our submarines and we can't actually give you any Virginia class submarines to get you from the Collins class, the current diesel electric submarines, to the future SSN. So is AUKUS turning into a Mission Impossible, do you think, with the UK kind of sitting on the, not on the sidelines, but sitting to one side, watching what unfolds in Australia and America politically and industrially?
I think the problem with AUKUS at the moment is that scepticism that we're seeing in the US political class, because what the US is giving to Australia or selling to Australia is Virginia class submarines at a time when the US cannot build enough Virginias for its own use, much less giving a couple, three, however many, to the Australians. So it seems to me to be very possible that in a year or so time, we'll see the Trump administration or the Republican-controlled Congress saying, well, you know, we can't fix our submarine industrial base to the point where we can produce enough Virginias for us. This seems like a stupid time to be selling Virginias to the Australians. We're terribly sorry. We're just not going to be able to do it. Don't knock yourselves out with the AUKUS design, but we're not going to help you bridge between the Collins and the new design. And I don't think, if that were to happen, I don't think that kills the AUKUS deal. I think it would be a huge disappointment, and I think it would cause some problems. But ultimately, the really important thread of the AUKUS deal is that new SSN design. And as long as the Americans stick to that part of the deal in terms of sharing technology for the creation of this new SSN AUKUS, because that's going to be built in the UK and Australia, so the difficulties with the US industrial base don't affect that in quite the same way. So as long as we can get over the line with the technology sharing, I think AUKUS will, you know, kind of 75% survive. But I don't think that means we should give up on the Virginias either. And I think it's incumbent on the UK and Australia to make that argument to the incoming Trump administration. Because although there's a lot of skepticism, the administration and the Republican Party generally is very conscious of the threat from China. And the point of the AUKUS deal is to balance against a rising China and to give more deterrence opportunities and to give Australia the capability to support the US, the UK and other allies in the region. So it's possible to make the argument for AUKUS based on things that the Republicans think are important. I think it's incumbent on us to do that and not just to give up and think, oh, well, they're not going to keep the deal. Let's give up and do something else. We have to try to make the argument.
And do you not think that what we might end up with, let's say the Americans do go down the path under President Trump of saying we want all the Virginias we can get, and so we just can't give them to you, of the Americans still going ahead with a squadron of submarines at Fremantle and basically saying to the Australians, a bit like we did, the Royal Navy did in until the 60s, I think the late 60s, which was to have British submarines, diesel submarines based in Australia, and the crews were mixed, Australian and British. So could that not be what happens in the end, that there's, let's say, five or six American SSNs there in Australia and maybe one British, and that would be it, with the Australians getting ready for the SSN AUKUS by basically help crew those submarines? Could that be what we end up with?
It could well be. I think there's a lot of options in terms of getting a similar capability outcome that doesn't involve the Virginias, and that is the solution you've just said, I think, is definitely one of those. The problem with this is not what was agreed. So there is the kind of reputational cost to the US of pulling out of a tripartite deal with two of its closest allies is not insubstantial. And although Trump has never been shy about pulling the US out of things that he doesn't like, it is something that the Republican administration should consider, because if the US is going to break a deal of this importance, then that really does bring into question its other commitments elsewhere. We also have to think about what the Australians will want. I mean, having an Australian sovereign capability is a very, very different beast to having US and British submarines permanently based on your territory. And although the Australians might get a similar security outcome from both of those options, having your own sovereign capability is obviously going to be a better choice. And it depends how much leverage the Australians have with the Trump administration and with Congress to be able to make that argument from their end. In terms of the British side, you know, we were already going to have Royal Navy submarine based in Australia anyway under AUKUS. I don't think we have the capability to add any more than one at the moment, and I don't think that's going to change. So I think for the British side of things, it will be the SSN AUKUS design process that will really be the important thing for the Royal Navy to focus on. So it may well be that we let the Australians and the Americans figure out the basing side themselves, and then we just come in and support them.
Yeah, I think that's probably what could happen. Who knows? We'll see what happens under Donald Trump, the comeback president. And that enables us to segue to another bit of the US Navy and its business, which is what it does in European waters. And Donald Trump takes office in January, and there have, of course, been not ructions, but disagreements over NATO spending, you know, percentage of GDP for each nation, with Europe being called on, in fact, by presidents prior to President Trump, to spend more. And I just wonder, can you see, or rather, what is your view of President Trump coming in and possibly saying, right, we're going to focus on China, we're going to scale back American NATO, but not pull out altogether? And would you, do you think he would, for example, take some of the destroyers, the Arleigh Burke-class destroyers that are currently based in Rota in Spain on ballistic missile defence duties, up to six under President Biden? Can you see a possibility that President Trump might, as a way of putting pressure on European NATO and also facing China, scale that back from six destroyers, as it's supposed to be, to four, or pull them out altogether?
I mean, first of all, I don't say this very often, but Trump is right about this. And European nations have had 30 years to spend more on their own defence, and they haven't, or not enough. And there does come a point where I can completely understand his frustration that America has been shouldering the burden of NATO defence this entire time. And although, you know, certain member states are more delinquent than others when it comes to their budgets, but ultimately, I don't think one could argue that any of the European NATO members or Canada has spent enough on their defence over the last 30 years. I think now we're seeing some states really showing the way forward on this. So if you look at Poland, our new Scandinavian allies, you know, they're really focusing on pushing up their defence budgets and spending that money to up their capabilities. So coming at this from a British point of view, we need to think about what is our contribution to NATO. Our contribution is predominantly maritime. You know, whether that's what we do well, we're an island, as the cliche goes. And most of our contribution to any NATO response to continued Russian aggression in Europe will be naval. So aircraft carriers, etc., and anti-submarine operations in the North Atlantic, Barents Sea, and so on. So our contribution is naval, and that is what we should be focused on. I think the strategic defence review that will be coming out in the next couple of months will be really indicative of how the new government views this problem. Because, as you said, it is very, very likely that even if America stays in NATO, which I think it will, it is very likely to be predominantly focused on the Indo-Pacific for the foreseeable future. And if there is a conflict in the Indo-Pacific first, that will probably mean that the US will say, guys, you need to hold the Euro-Atlantic. we're focused on the Indo-Pacific. We don't need you to support us with combat operations with us in the Indo-Pacific. We have other allies. We're good. But you need to hold the Euro-Atlantic and make sure to contain Russia. And although European allies are now being woken up to the threat from Russia, it's one of those things where you think, well, why didn't you think of this 10 years ago when Vladimir Putin first invaded Ukraine? Why didn't you think about it when he invaded Georgia? Why didn't you think about it before, et cetera, et cetera? So I can really, really understand the American frustration that they have been shouting this for a very long time, as have a lot of us within European countries as well. And it has taken this level of crisis to focus the mind. So Europe needs to be ready to hold the Euro-Atlantic against Russia without significant American help. I don't think America will abandon us, but I think we need to rely in our planning on minimal American support and not rely on a full security umbrella as we have been previously. I don't know what that will mean for specific deployments. I would hope that what will happen is a cycling out. So if America needs to take some ships away, for example, it will do that when they can be replaced with equivalent from Britain or France or whoever else. That's what I would hope. I hope we're not going to be left with gaps because of it. But that's going to be down to Europe. And if we don't have the capabilities, we need to buy them pretty quick.
Yeah. And as you were saying that, the thing that occurred to me was that there does still seem to be an air of unreality or lack of grip in some nations when it comes to the scale of the threat and how deterrent works, etc. Not in Poland, not in the Baltics, maybe, but Britain, for example. And if we look at the foretaste of SDR, the Strategic Defence Review, that is allegedly going to report next spring in the UK, then of course the indicator, one of the indicators of thinking was the idea that the LPDs, the landing platform docks, the amphibious warfare command ships, Albion and Bulwark, could be discarded, and two wave tankers, fleet tankers, because they were old and they'd done their bit. And I just wondered what kind of message that sent to America, because really the average life of a tanker, particularly something like the Waves, should really be 30 years at least. And the same goes for the amphibious ships. And it reminded me of thinking about World War II. So prior to World War II, you had battleships that were devised to do one particular job, which was to fight other battleships. And then as time evolved, and particularly during World War II, very rapidly, then they went from fighting other surface ships into shore bombardment. And of course, they did their share of escort duty as well. And it seems to me that an argument was being made in government circles that, for example, the Albion and Bulwark were old-fashioned and there was never going to be another D-Day and they weren't needed anymore and we're moving forward with other things, although they couldn't say what other things are. But in fact, the landing platform docks are used for a variety of jobs, evacuating people from war zones, supplying humanitarian aid and disaster relief, operating as a base for drones, you know, all sorts of roles beyond this outmoded idea of D-Day. So they had a way to evolve, and other nations are investing in them, you know, China, America, I think Peru, and also Turkey, etc. So they aren't outmoded. It's just, in my mind, the reason for the cut without any replacement for the Albion and Bulwark was no people due to recruitment and retention problem, no money, not even a minor amount of money. And for the Waves, a similar thing, no people to take them to sea and no money to actually get them out there. So do you think that that was a bad message to the world and also to President Trump getting rid of those four ships, and also that the reality was it was no money and no people? It wasn't just that they weren't needed.
I think the thing we have to remember with these ships specifically is we can't hold on to ships that are not cost effective. We don't have the money to do that. So the amount of money it would have taken to refit, maintain, and get these ships back in service is a lot more than it is to get a new capability, i.e. the MRSS in terms of Albion and Bullock.
That's the replacement
platform, the multi-role for the support Marines. Ship. Yeah. The problem with this is the government announced the cut and then we have this gap before we decide on the replacement. And I think that's what's really weird about this in particular, is that usually when we're making these decisions, you say, right, we are going to procure three of these. These will replace these three. And it's all done in one. But to have this odd kind of purgatory in between the two, I think is the really bizarre thing.
Yeah.
So I'm not against getting rid of Albion and Bulwark and the Waves. And I am very hopeful that those capabilities will be replaced within the SDR announcements. But it's just very strange having this period in between where we've cut the ships and we don't know what's going to replace them. And I think that is the part that sends the odd message, because there's no reason why that announcement of the cuts can be made at the same time as the announcement of the replacements. So it seems like a very specific choice, and I'm not sure I understand why that choice was made. But if we're going to see replacements for both of those capabilities in the SDR, then I don't have a problem with getting rid of them.
Yeah. I would, you know, on balance, I would agree with you there. And I agree it's strange the way they did it. And I think you can understand Northumberland, because, you know, if it's going to cost a massive amount of money to make that elderly Type 23 frigate ready for service when there's new frigates being built and will be in service within, 4 or 5 years, then it would, you know, it's not something to worry about as much as something that is discarded with no idea what's coming next. So, yeah, I would agree with you there.
Absolutely. And especially with Northumberland, I mean, the sheer amount of money it would take to get her floating again is ridiculous. And, you know, the Royal Navy shouldn't be in the business of classic car restoration. You know, you're not going to make it float again just because we love her. You know, we can't make decisions based on that. So, unfortunately, we are where we are.
Yeah. And I mean, turning back to the US Navy, I just wondered what your thoughts were on any lessons or the way things are going with the Middle East and particularly the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, because obviously, and this shows how suddenly investment in warships that are highly capable with people that are highly trained pays off. And it might take years to happen, but if you didn't do it 20, 30 years ago, then you wouldn't have them, because we have the mainstay there is the Arleigh Burke class destroyer of the US Navy, and also high-end anti-ballistic missile capability. So is that contest, if we can call it that, between the Houthis and the US Navy and also European navies, the Royal Navy and the Italian Navy and others, is that an indicator of the way things are going to be in other parts of the world, do you think? I mean, is it going well for the US Navy? Is it putting a major strain on the US Navy to do that, do you think?
I think what the kind of high-level lesson from this deployment is that you cannot predict where you're going to need to send your ships. And we've, a lot of us have been thinking in a very binary terms between the Indo-Pacific war with China, Euro-Atlantic war with Russia. But there are so many other things that could go wrong in the world where you need to have a naval presence. And the Houthi threat has been one of those. Nobody would have predicted that the Houthis would have this kind of impact on global shipping, that they'd be able to do it for so long, and that they would be able to have their weapons flow from Iran be reasonably stable for so long. So it really hammers home that to have a decent navy, you have to be flexible. You have to have the capabilities in the numbers required to be able to respond to threats like this. And, you know, the US has been trying to get out of the Middle East for, 30 years now, and they're still there. We've all tried to pivot to the Indo-Pacific, and we're all still in the Middle East. So, you know, as much as you want to be able to plan for a one theatre war or one and a half theatre war or whatever terminology you want to use, other stuff is going to happen. And if you want to use your navy for global security, then you need to be able to respond to it. So that's kind of the big kind of overarching lesson from the Houthis. The other is the impact that the Houthis have had with quite low-level weapons. And there's that kind of cost differential, that the cost per shot of what the Houthis are throwing at us is wildly lower than the cost per shot of what we're using to intercept them. And that's always going to be a problem with non-state actors, because they can create these problems, create this conflict without spending the kind of money that we have to spend to defend against it. I don't know how you fix that. I guess, you know, when we're starting to see a lot more integration of uncrewed systems, that might help, because then you'll have systems that are attritable, that are cheaper, that we could maybe use a lot more against these kind of threats. But at the moment, you're using a $100,000 missile to shoot down a $5,000 threat, and we're just going to have to spend that money.
And might it accelerate lasers as a countermeasure, do you think? And also see certain kinds of guns come back? Do you think that might be part of the answer, as well as counter drones, if you like?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the stuff we're seeing with, like, Dragonfire, for example, is really promising.
It's a laser, isn't it?
Sorry, it's a laser, but, yes. Yeah. It's the Royal Navy project. And I think having that option would be really handy for solving this, because a laser shot, as far as I know, costs essentially the cost of the electricity to power it. So, you know, $10 maybe a shot. So that would really solve the money problem. It does mean you have to have a very substantial power source for that laser. And there may be problems in, if you're using it a lot, whether you'd be able to have the power requirements, but that's all stuff we can figure out. Laser weapons, I think, will play a very central role in air defence for fleets, and for kind of dealing with missiles kind of being flung from any group in the desert somewhere.
And looking at drones, what about the impact for the US Navy? How big, in terms of impact and significance, are drones going to be? You were talking about mass earlier, obviously presence as well, being in many more seas, oceans, etc. as well. So how large are they going to loom in the future of the US Navy, do you think?
I think very large. I think if you can get it right, uncrewed systems can solve a lot of the problems that the US Navy is facing, problems that we have in common in a lot of other Western navies. So as you say, mass, persistence, and ISR generally, I think, because, you know, the oceans are huge, and, you know, there's a lot of ISR that we can do from space, but sometimes you just need something floating in the place where you want to look. And to be able to do that with uncrewed systems, I think, will be a game changer. It also means you can take people out of danger a lot more. So although uncrewed systems don't necessarily need fewer people to operate them, it does mean that those people who are operating them are not directly being shot at, which can only be a good thing. And it looks to be very promising for things like mine clearance as well. Again, a very dangerous job, that if you have a person doing it, that person is in a lot of danger. But if you can use an uncrewed system, if you lose one of your drones, that's fine. If you lose a person, that's terrible. So it's all these different capabilities and different problem sets that different uncrewed systems will solve. It means that the whole kind of concept of uncrewed systems, I think, will be really pervasive across the entirety of the fleet structure. What will really be interesting to see is how fleets think about integrating those into their fleet structure, because I don't think we're going to see navies that don't have traditional crewed platforms. You're not going to see the end of aircraft carriers, destroyers, frigates, and so on. It's how they work together with those uncrewed systems, and how those uncrewed systems enhance these capabilities and extend those capabilities. But to do that, you have to have the doctrine, the planning, the operational side, all of that locked in, then the logistics, maintenance, and so on. So it's a really wicked problem. But I think it's something that we're going to see all kind of modern navies moving into, because the upside just seems so huge.
And what about some general observations on the US Navy and where it stands as we maybe come to the end of this section of the podcast?
I think the really important thing is going to be how the new administration thinks about the US Navy. The US Navy has always been good at advocating for itself. I think it's just whether this is an administration that is going to be navally focused. I guess. And the future of the US Navy does depend ultimately on investment, and that's investment of money, investment of political will, and investment of the thought necessary to be able to plan a good future for the US Navy, particularly at a time with a lot of pressure from China, from Russia, non-state actors, and so on. So I'm really hopeful that the next administration will grasp the nettle on these problems. If it doesn't, then the US Navy will be another 4 years behind where it should be, and that would be a real problem. I don't think that the US Navy is ever going to fall behind China qualitatively, but this quantitative side of things that we talked about earlier, that is something that they're going to have to grapple with. And it's having that mass, building smaller ships, but lots of them, building uncrewed systems, making sure that you have all of those working together. And if there is the political will and the money and the time to be able to do that properly, I think the US Navy will just go from strength to strength. But that is the question, is there?
Yeah, thanks. That's some good insights there and observations. And it strikes me that some people might wonder why we're spending so much time talking about the US Navy and its doings and its future and what it hopes to achieve and isn't achieving. But there's no two ways about it. Without the presence of the United States Navy out there, in my opinion, on the world's oceans, I mean, just look at the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, with those capabilities and all those people and those ships, the world would be a much more dangerous place and a chaotic place. So do you think that's the case, that we all should look at the US Navy and hope that it's in a good state?
Absolutely. I think ultimately the United States, whether we like it or not, is the guarantor of security for all of us as allies and partners and friends. And the US Navy is such an vital part of that. And even though I suspect America will not be quite so focused on that under Trump as it was previously, I don't think it's going to abandon us. I don't think America will pull back so much that we will have problems. But I think we should all recognise that looking at the US Navy, cheerleading the US Navy, working with the US Navy, like all of that is going to be important in building up all of our security. Because if you're on deployment with the US Navy as a ship of another Navy, you're building those connections, but you're also sharing best practice, you're working together, you're making sure that in the event of a crisis, like a proper crisis, all those navies could work together to fix that. And the US Navy is always going to be the linchpin for all of those efforts, whether that's in NATO, in the Indo-Pacific, wherever else. The US Navy is really good at it, and we're going to have to rely on them to keep being.
That's a very good thought to end on, at least this section of the chat before I go to David. And thank you very much, Emma, for talking to us on this episode of the podcast.
It was a pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And I'd just like to remind people at the end of this episode that the Guide to US Navy is on sale in the USA, the UK, and globally, and you can get it direct from the publishers, Sundial Magazines, as well as look for it in shops. And it's well worth a look. I know I'm biased in that I'm saying that, in that it's 96 pages of amazing photos, analysis, commentaries, ship profiles, unit profiles. It's action-packed and well worth a buy, in my opinion. And when it comes to the monthly edition of the magazine, of Warships International Fleet Review, the January edition is the current edition, out from 20th of December, selling in the UK and globally, including, of course, the USA and other markets. And that is also well worth a read, and includes a look at the UK's latest defence cuts, such as the warships that were discussed in the podcast that have been dispensed with. Also in there, also relevant to the podcast, is something on the naval impact of the Donald Trump comeback as president, along with more on the Ukraine war. The head of the Pakistan Navy is also interviewed there. That's well worth a read. A profile of a new Italian patrol ship, and much, much more. And I heartily recommend it. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at WarshipsIFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at WarshipsIFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.